Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
We have now around 10 minutes again for questions and comments, and I should, before we do that, introduce Dr. Colin Hankinson, who's the Chief Executive of the University of Chester Academies Trust, which is currently five academies based in the Northwest, but I understand that's already five and growing, and it's a kind of an organisation which is a subsidiary of the University of Chester. And Colin, as you'll see from the agenda, is running one of the two seminars in the next and final slot of the day, which is looking at sponsorship of academies and free schools. But we'll anchor this discussion really around the future of partnerships, whether that is between institutions or between schools and higher education, and indeed other terms that Graham coined at the start of the day, where third sector and other organisations can play a role in forging some of those partnerships. But also, I suppose, what is linked directly to this is the wider question of information, advice and guidance, because clearly that is critical in terms of informing and supporting predominantly young people, but all sorts of learners that want to go on into further study or their wider kind of careers options. So it's a kind of a, I wouldn't say a free-for-all, but it's a kind of an open discussion in that respect for 10 minutes. So we'll see again who wants to go first. It's always the first one that's the toughest. Right. I've got one, and I'm sure you know some of you will want to come in. And I suspect, in some respects, it's for Randy first, but people might have other speakers, panelists might have a view, which is really looking about the growing importance of peer-to-peer support when it comes to informing young people about the future, and also the role of social media, the internet and so on in terms of providing information, advice and guidance. It was interesting that when it was presented in your presentation, Andy, about where young people go to get information, kind of parents, families, schools, teachers, siblings and so on. But I get the sense, I have no data on this, but that's why I asked the question, how important are things like the student room, where kind of current undergraduates are speaking about their experience in all manner of lurid detail and so on? And it's easy for a 16 or 17-year-old to, when they're sitting down with their UCAS form, to kind of log in. And to what extent can universities, you know, I'm sure universities' marketing and recruitment teams, you know, they'll cast an eye over it. And some of the things they'll look on there and think, yeah, that's accurate. Others of it, they'll look at that and probably go, I'm not sure I do recognise this. What can institutions do in that respect? So it's a two-part question, really. How important is it, do you think? And what can institutions do to kind of engage in that sphere?
I think it's really, really important. And certainly, I think if you look back 10 years, if you talked about peer-to-peer, you thought of a student ambassador going into a school and delivering something. And the idea of having mentoring or social media was something that was very new at that stage, and it's certainly expanded a lot over the last few years. And it is an incredibly well-utilised resource that students use, hopefully in addition to information that they're getting from other forms of IAG, but there will certainly be some students who rely on social media and these kind of outlets to make their decisions. And I think from most institutions' point of view, a lot of the time they tend to be the bane of our lives because the information on there isn't verified. A lot of the information you look at and you is inherently untrue. So it is very difficult to kind of encourage students to go down to look at them and to go down that route of using the social media simply because institutions don't have that control over it and the guidance that are on there. Certainly some institutions have encouraged student ambassadors and the like to get logging in and setting up profiles on websites and actually providing that input supported by the institutions. I can see the benefits behind that because you get an understanding of the information that's being put on there, but it kind of takes away from the point of it actually being independent in the first place. So I think it's very, very difficult. It's a very difficult balancing act, and I don't know if anyone from institutions in the room has kind of got a policy or a way that you actually deal with this. But yeah, it certainly is rather tricky.
I think what we've seen with social media more generally, in its nicest way, you could describe it as the kind of the democratisation of information. The holders of information, traditionally those that kind of, in some senses, either came from the establishment or were of the establishment or were holding a corporate position, that's suddenly been opened out such that you're competing with anyone that wants to put information out there. And in many respects, you're all given an equal footing. And I do think that I draw this analogy with a great deal of caution, but if you can see the power of what social media started to do, it played a significant role in the downfall of governing regimes in North Africa. I'm not saying, I draw this with caution, I'm not saying it's going to bring the downfall of institutions, but I do think it will revolutionise the way in which information is, in which young people access information about their institutions. And I suspect it is a challenge for institutions to think about how you enter that sphere. On a kind of pedagogical side, we've seen some discomfort around institutions. It's a difficult thing. Do your academics wade into Facebook discussions about learning and teaching issues? It's a difficult thing to do because students sometimes see that as their space. But I think when it comes to critical IAG that students will need and want, it's a difficult space to go into. I see a semi-raised hand.
Thank you. I'm Adam Powell from Bath Spa University. I just want to make a couple of points, actually. First, I think you're absolutely right, Andy, to talk about the IAG elements of what HALOA members can offer. And I'm glad you made the distinction between the I and the A and the G, which can be very specialised kind of support. I think, however, it's up for universities to present a kind of unified service to schools that actually between WP and marketing teams, with the support of careers and employability professionals, that universities can provide that service. So I think, I'd like to, certainly with my institution, we're trying to provide a much more joined up service for schools. The second point in terms of who is providing IAG, I think you overlook one significant stakeholder, and that is the input that employers can make. And certainly you mentioned as part of your Bright Futures programme, just last month, the CBI launched its Education and Skills annual report. And actually, one of the strongest messages that came through was that employers wanted more engagement with schools in terms of supporting careers advice. So I think the model I think Mary talked about with the tripartite agreement between schools, universities and employers, I think can make a very strong model in terms of moving that forward.
If I can just come back on that, I think I couldn't be more true. I think we're really seeing I've been in this space for 20 years and it's really been in the last year, 18 months, I've really seen employers wanting to reach out and engage much more and help with those choices. Part of what's been driving that is the sheer volume of poor applications they get from people who don't really, particularly over the last couple of years, this kind of scattergun approach to applications by students. So they're making a decision, we've got to go into universities and into schools and better educate students about the kind of opportunities we've got so they can make more informed and better choices. So you're really seeing an appetite from employers to do that. Now, of course, the challenge for employers is they can't be everywhere. And that's their big challenge, particularly with school. Tough enough targeting universities as a graduate employer. But if as part of your long-term strategy you want to develop relationships with schools, where do you start with 4,000 schools across the UK? And I think that's what they're currently, right now, as I sit here in this room today, that's what employers are struggling with, is what schools do we target and on what basis do we target those schools?
Colin.
If I may on this one. It's an interesting point in relation to what you're saying. If you look at the academies movement as a whole, and you think of an academy being an independent, state-funded education institution, essentially, and there are certain sub-elements of it, one of them being UTCs, or University Technical Colleges. Now, this is something that the Baker Deering Trust, headed up by Lord Baker, are promoting very effectively. And in fact, UCAT are going to put a bid in for a couple of UTCs over the next 12 months. Now, interestingly on that, employers are actually getting involved as partners in UTCs. So they're getting involved helping support. I mean, blue chip organizations are getting involved in helping and supporting. And, one proposal that we're putting forward would involve O2 as a main partner. So they're quite serious players. So it's this idea of organisations now actively getting involved in the 14 through 19 bracket to create the type of curriculum to, in this case, to provide high-level technical abilities that the technicians can utilise for employment in the future, which, of course, has implication for that. Yeah. Now, also, and I won't go on too long on this one, if you look at UTCs, they've been promoted fairly effectively for 3 years now, and there's been two rounds of funding bids for, a couple hundred million a year. There's something like 40, I think, been actually funded. Don't quote me on that. It's around about 40. And hopefully the same, another 20 or 30 next year. So it's quite an important part of the academy's development and quite an important integration between employers and, mainstream education.
I've got two sort of quick comments about employers. I mean, the first is that I think it's a bit of a myth to suggest that employers have suddenly had some kind of great dissatisfaction with graduates. I'm assured that it wasn't just in the 1960s there were issues with graduates that came out of universities. In the 1860s, similarly they were saying, why is it that what our universities do don't quite make graduates immediately ready? And there's a debate to be had about the extent to which it is universities' role to deliver people that are immediately oven ready for the world of work. Clearly there is an important role to ensure they are work ready, but whether they are kind of completely ready to go on day one, that there is of course a role for employers to provide some training to their workforce, not just at the point of entry, but beyond that. But I think we are starting to see, as been slightly alluded to, employers starting to say, actually, we can't just, as we maybe have done for the last 50 years or the last 150 years, stand back from the sidelines and say, we've got a problem with graduates. What can they do to roll up their sleeves and actually engage with schools and higher education to actually say, how can we, in instances, work together, either to help inform and to an extent shape the curriculum, but also, perhaps more crucially, shape the kinds of skills, transferable skills, that graduates and school leavers are coming out with. Yes.
Hi, Rachel Edwell, Head of Outreach and Recruitment at Anglia Ruskin. Going back to the beginning of the point that you made actually beforehand about the IAG and working with multiple universities, I think there's a really difficult balance actually that schools have to think about, in the sense of, in an ideal world, IAG and all of its sort of stances would be delivered by, a cross-section of HEIs, colleges, so on and so forth. However, the point that my colleague made over there about the fact that actually organisation to organisation has a totally different thing to offer. I completely agree with the fact that HEIs aren't generally set up to offer guidance. However, I know we do, in certain other organisations, work with our own careers and employability teams, and there are certain things that different universities have to offer. So my point being is that it might be more realistic, that schools, yes, may be able and want to work with more than one HEI, but the number can't be so vast that they don't understand the sort of portfolio of knowledge that those institutions can actually offer them. So I suppose it's a comment more than a question, really, but it's quite a difficult task, and I think there's an ideal scenario, and possibly the realistic scenario is something slightly different.
I suppose briefly linked to that, I'll say something, and then I'll invite the panellists to kind of offer any final words, is I think what we are dealing with is a series of moving targets as well. So if the school's landscape is changing, rather similar to one of Simon's early slides, the school's landscape is changing in terms of their capacity and their provision. The situation for young people themselves is changing. The raising of the school leaving age might change the way in which there is a mindset about where next. The kind of ongoing difficulties around youth unemployment present challenges about where young people might want to go. And it is interesting that at each recession over the last sort of 50 years, there's a spike. There's a kind of, in some respects, a counterintuitive spike in terms of the numbers of people enrolling onto further and particularly higher education, even though now there's kind of an added financial risk, perhaps, is at least perceived, although, of course, it's offset against it's really an income contingent loan. And then also for universities themselves, it's quite a changing landscape. So on that basis, with these kind of three plates spinning, any final reflections on where kind of what the future of partnerships and information, advice and guidance might look like? I'll start with Simon and work around.
Okay, so no time to think about that one. Yep. Excellent. Yep. Thanks, Aaron. Really appreciate that. I think the thought I've got going through my head is that I think it's a huge ask, the guidance piece. I think it's just a tremendous ask. But I think for me, you know, as fundamentally we're talking about young people, information and advice is the key, and it's about getting them engaged in getting that information and advice. And I think for me, it's the engagement piece that's so, so important. You've always got, we have it at universities, have it in schools, there's a, you know, small percentage of students who are very, very engaged and absolutely get it and are involved in everything and are brilliantly proactive. Then you've got a group who are the best one in the world, are always going to be really, really hard work. And then you've got this huge rump in the middle that are like, don't know what to do, a bit frightened of where I go, how do I get the information? And I think if we can engage more of those through information and advice to at least help them start to make better decisions, not saying it's the perfect decision, but better decisions, I think that for me feels like a much more achievable objective in terms of what we're trying to do.
Andy.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. I think it's about being realistic about what we can actually kick out and deliver. And to take your point, I think there are institutions out there that can go and deliver this guidance to some groups of students. And it would be interesting to have this discussion again in 2 or 3 years' time and see where the kind of the ballpark is then. I think it's just such a changeable position at the moment. Institutions are still kind of making their mind up exactly what kind of support they can give and still making these strategic plans long term. So I think it's an improving picture, but certainly the I and the A, if we can get that right and get that to everyone, then we're in a better position than we are at the moment, perhaps.
It's a really interesting question, and in the sort of many talks I get involved with, I tend to get one form or another this is asked to me. How can you be impartial if you're essentially a university sponsor? So, you know, we have, at the moment, involved with 7 secondary academies, 2 that we co-sponsor and 5 that we lead sponsor. The aim is to have 10 plus by the end of this year and something in the region of circa 25 in 18 months, 2 years, within the northwest of England. So, of course, the cynics say, well, that's wonderful because as a higher education institution, you know, it's we're a wholly owned subsidiary of the University of Chester. I think that's an important point. But, you know, the cynics say, well, yes, that's all very nice. You're a HEI and you have all these schools and surely you're going to, you know, direct the students to your... And, of course, this is a discussion that we had 5 years ago when we put the, you know, the internal discussions about the direction we wanted to go in. And I can assure you it's all about best advice for the students. It's all about enhancing life possibilities for the students. And, in fact, our academies are... earlier type of academies coming from the bottom 300 performing schools in very difficult circumstances. So our aim, and we show that on the ground, is to offer the very best advice for the student, irrespective of the direction of travel in terms of HEI or whatever. Yes, some come to the University of Chester, some go to others. We will always direct them towards what we feel is best for them. I think that's quite an important point. Because it's always something that's pointed out, and universities involved with academies. So.
And I think the other thing that you also did, and it's important to point out now, is you know, the academies of the last 18 months are different to the origins
very
of, the,
different beasts.
Of the FB academies that were first developed under the previous administration. That is the end of the kind of the formal presentations that we've had. Can I ask you just to again thank the speakers very much for their presentations. We now have a 15-minute break, and then there are 2 seminars that run parallel for sort of 40 minutes or so. The first with Colin is looking at academies and free schools and sponsorship, and the second is from Tom, who's at the front here, from Push and they're looking at the pros and cons of outreach, and I should perhaps say a word about a push they kind of deliver talks in schools as well as information advice about higher education and different institutions. I believe, and I wait to get corrected, that the Collins session is in here. And yeah, that's correct. And Tom's will be not in here. Not in here. I won't get to speak with everyone kind of in plenary again. So if you wouldn't mind just spending 90 seconds, 60 seconds, 90 seconds, just filling out these forms. It's just helpful in terms of just getting some feedback in terms of what's worked and what's worked less well. It's likely that given that this is an agenda that isn't going to go away in a hurry, that perhaps, you know, in 10 or 12 months' time, we might find ourselves here, so it would be helpful in terms of future development as well. So if you wouldn't mind that. And for those of you I don't see in the rest of the day, safe journey home, and I'm sure I'll see you at something soon. So that's how the world works. Right, thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.